Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. One such passion for my guest is leadership and the future of America. Colonel Joshua M. McConkie, MD, who has served in the military for more than two decades. He's been an ER doctor for more than 20 years. He's run for Congress. He's taught at Duke University. He's written an award-winning and best-selling book. It's called The Weight Behind the Spear. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Josh, go to joshmcconkieforamerica.com, or you can go to weightbehindthespear.com, and you can follow him on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, YouTube, and X. And Dr. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ira. I appreciate you having me on.
So what is the metaphor behind the weight behind the spear?
So for me, that's my personal leadership ethos. I've been in the military for 22, 23 years, and I've worked with a lot of special operations. And these are some men and women that we call the tip of the spear. So these are the ones that are kicking down doors, doing some pretty amazing things. And we can't all do that, right? I don't take lives, I save them. And for every American out there, we can't always be that tip of the spear, but we can be the weight behind that spear. So getting involved in your community, whether you're a teacher, a coach, family, mentors, or volunteers, we can all get behind this generation and be the weight behind their spear for the future of our country. And that's been my personal leadership ethos for a while.
And that vision is somewhat optimistic as opposed to a lot of people these days that are pessimistic about the future of the country, but yours is very optimistic. I should also point out that you could use the term wait in another context, WAIT, and having patience for those warriors who are out there being the spear.
Yeah, absolutely.
So either way would work very well. Well, what's your main focus in terms of the people that you want to read the book? Your main focus is for parents, all of the community, kids to read. How do you see that?
So anybody who's going to interact with this generation of Americans, this is the most politically and generationally divided our country has been in a very long time. And I think this youngest generation of Americans has really been just lost. So I call it the COVID generation. This is the generation that was shut out of their schools, was shut out of churches. They literally have difficulty communicating with other people if it's not over an iPhone or iPad. And so this generation right here, anybody who's going to interact, teachers, family, parents, and business leaders. I think a lot of business leaders don't realize that this is your problem, whether you deal with it now or you wait until they come into the workforce and lack a lot of these skills. The earlier you get engaged, the better. So anyone who's going to interact with this generation.
That's something you said that's pretty important, that we are, in a sense, a nation divided, not necessarily just politically, but generationally, culturally, et cetera. It's a tough road to hoe, but you're a tough guy, given your background. Huh. And you are trying to inspire people to, in essence, be the weight behind the spear and support what can be the future of America. Are you guardingly optimistic about what's going to happen in the next 5 to 10 to 20 years?
Being a military commander, I get a lot of those security briefings, a lot of that classified. But just bottom line, there's a lot of threats to America. You know, number one being the Chinese Communist Party and potential conflict in the Pacific that nobody wants that to happen. But this younger generation really lacks a lot of the leadership skills, the ability to communicate, and really the ability to just adapt and overcome obstacles. They just have a difficult time with some of the most simplest obstacles, to be honest. They just don't have that ability to adapt. And we need to teach them those skills. This is everybody's responsibility. You, me, our teachers, everybody in America has a role to play here. So this is really important. I'm concerned enough to write the book, right, but I do have a lot of optimism that if we do the right thing and build this generation up, we're going to be just fine. America has overcome a lot, and I expect it to do so, but we need everyone to get engaged in their communities.
You said something about the different skills that kids today or young people today don't have that they used to have, people used to have. Can you give us an example or two of that? I think that'd be important to point out.
Well, for me, this generation, they get bullied online. You know, when I got bullied, or I got bullied a little bit when I was in middle school and high school, you had to get up in somebody's face. You had to punch them in the nose. Now with social media, it's omnipresent. These kids are online, boy, some of them almost 24/7, and they can be harassed and bullied every second of their lives just on their media accounts. It's really unique to this generation, and it has a big impact on their mental health. It's really part of the mental health crisis that's affecting America. And as an emergency doctor, that's what I see. So I see the anxiety, the depression, and some of the rising suicide rates, which is just brutal. It rips my heart out every single time. But these are the things that I deal with on a daily basis that has me concerned enough to get out there and try to do something about it.
Just to simplify it, though, wouldn't one of the answers to that being bullied on social media is not to go on social media and then
that would make sense and that would be easy. And there's a lot of generations that can just shut it off.
Right.
But for these younger generations, that's their entire life. That's what they know. That's how they connect with the outside world. That's how they talk to their friends. So shutting that off is essentially just shutting off their life, you know, from their side of things. So it's not always that easy.
Well, do you see that reflected in households that have good parents who are doing good parenting, and yet still the kids are in their own world on social media and they're getting bullied and getting into areas they shouldn't be getting into, and the parents have no clue or are not able to help them?
There's wide variations in the parenting styles. I mean, I came from a family of five children. So, you know, we've all got three or four kids. We all parent a little bit differently, and you can see some of the outcomes from the social media. I know my children don't have any social media accounts at all. You know, we allow them to use the iPads and for some educational things and playing some gaming and things like that, but they do not have any social media accounts. The American Academy of Pediatrics has some great guidelines on that. Me being a physician, I do try to stick to those, but the more involved those parents are, generally, you're going to see some better outcomes from the social media induced anxiety and depression and things that you'll see. So the parents have a huge part to play.
Do your kids feel somewhat deprived because they are not allowed access to devices and online interests other than the educational iPad?
We get that all the time. And it's the same thing my parents told me, you know, 30, 40 years ago, just with some different topics. But, you know, there's parents out there who have 11-year-old kids watching the new Deadpool movie. And I love Deadpool. I've seen the movie myself. And I seriously question some of the parents that are having their 11 and 12-year-olds watching that movie. And my children, well, come on, everybody's watching it. This friend is doing it. And this parent took their kid to the movie. And I try to keep it calm inside. I know exactly what I'm thinking about some of those parents. There's different parenting styles. There is no way my 11-year-old child is going to be watching Deadpool.
You're looking at it from a very interesting perspective. You are obviously have a long career in the military and you have a long career in medicine. So you're seeing two different perspectives there. And so that's why I think when you chose to write the book, you came at it from those two unique, and maybe other perspectives that I might not be aware of. You may be also, I don't know, you might be a lawyer too. I mean, you've accomplished so much. So, but you're coming at it with several different perspectives. Do you find that parents too easily give up with the concept of parenting because they think it's too much pressure to do it right as you're doing it? In other words, well, you may be doing parts wrong, but I'm assuming you're doing
it. I'm not perfect, believe me.
Yeah, there you go. So, well, of course you're not perfect. You ran for office, so... Of course. Well, wait a minute. Didn't you win also a lottery?
I did. 1 month prior to our primary here in North Carolina, ran in North Carolina District 13.
I know we're off the topic, but I'm intrigued by that. So
yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, the North Carolina Educational Lottery. Super blessed. It really gave us the ability to get our message out. It was a very crowded race with 14 people. And for me, I got a lot of earned media attention. And for... You know, I'm nobody special. I'm just someone who really cares and deeply believes in what I do in the military and as an emergency physician. And that win gave us a lot of earned media that really helped propel us and get our message out.
Yeah. And then plus the money.
Yeah. The money, you know, people have asked that question. I did. There was a lottery podcast that I was asked to jump on several months ago. They can find that on my YouTube account. You know, I don't care about the money. I tell people the time that I spent in Iraq really changed me as a person because I got dropped into Iraq in 2007 as part of the surge. So there were 10,000 troops. I was one of those. The day I landed in theater, they shot down one of our helicopters. Over that previous two-week span, they shot down 8 helicopters, and they killed the flight surgeon, Colonel Allgood, just before I got there. And it put things into perspective for me very quickly. Nobody cares how big your house is. Nobody cares how much money you make. And nobody cares what kind of car you drive. You know, you're probably going to die here. And are you doing something that matters? And it took me about a two-week transition to where I had a little bit of break in just that mental psyche and just preparing myself that it's not that I was suicidal. I wanted to die. I just had to be okay with dying, and I had to get out there and do the job and do the mission. I flew medevac. I did one air assault, and I just realized nobody cares about the car or the money. They don't. It's either, do you want to live or do you want to die? And you got to take care of people around you. So it just changed me as a person. So I don't really care about the money. I care that it helped me get my message out.
I think in the war zone, you became, in essence, fatalistic, or needed to become fatalistic in order to cope. And I don't mean that as a negative thing. That's just an adaption issue.
It is. It's you have to adapt and you have to overcome, and the mission has to get done. There's men and women that are relying on you to take care of them and save lives, no matter what's going on around you. And coming home was much, much harder. When you've had that type of experience, and you know, people that talk about PTSD and mental health in our, you know, men and women that have deployed and been a part of combat operations, it's coming home that seems to be the most difficult. When you get there, it's sink or swim. And I promise you, you're going to swim because everybody wants to live. And then you come home and you're just dealing with some of the other things that you hadn't had to deal with for a long time, for, you know, the traditional civilian population that really hasn't had the opportunity to have those experiences. And that was the hardest part for me. When I moved back, I actually had met my wife, Elsa, and that's when we moved to New Zealand for a couple of years just to get my head straight. And I played soccer and worked a little ER in Rotorua. So that's how I did it.
Well, everybody has their own path. And in a way, your book, Be the Weight Behind the Spear, also communicates the weight behind the spear when you come home from the battlefield, meaning what's the homeland like for you, the civilian support system and the military support system that can help you once you come back from the battlefield? So there's all kinds of metaphors that are part behind the title of your book. Not necessarily that the book is about that, but I can see that applying in that case as well. When you look at the institutions in America, not just the military institutions, the civilian institutions and the school systems around the country, are you not optimistic, but are you okay with where things are in terms of what you want to accomplish with leadership and working with young people? In other words, are the institutions, there's a long way around it by asking, are the institutions there to support people that are growing up now that you want to help? Or are they less than they used to be in terms of education, for example, what they're taught, how they're taught, et cetera?
My wife is a teacher. My mom is a teacher. And so are my aunt Lonnie. And the current teachers really have been stripped of their power to really hold kids accountable. You know, teachers need to be empowered to do the right thing. And some great examples in my book, you know, from growing up in the 80s and 90s, I had some amazing teachers. And there were some great experiences that I was able to articulate into the book with some great stories. And I really owe it to all of those teachers and educators, mentors for me, coaches as well, that helped shape me. And they're still there and they're still working hard and they still want to do that. I think things have changed in our educational system, probably not for the better, in our ability to empower those teachers. I mean, they can't do much to hold them accountable. You know, if I got in trouble at school, I was in much more trouble when I came home. a little aggressive. I think my dad got that belt out a couple of times. That's really, really frowned upon these days.
Yes, absolutely.
I certainly do not do that with my children. But teachers need to be empowered. And I think that power has been stripped away just from the stories I've heard from my family that are all involved in education. It's unfortunate.
I think it's a combination also of not just the powers being taken away from the teachers, but a lot of parents seem to not be parents. And I've seen, talking about social media earlier, I've seen videos of confrontations that parents cause because their kid got into trouble, and they're the parents are blaming the school or the teacher or the administrator instead of their kids. And it's a psychology, but it's a pathology, one of the two, that takes into effect.
Yeah, it was never, it was always, what did you do? I mean, whether my teacher was right or wrong, it did not matter. It is my fault. Period. That's ultimate accountability. Whether it was somebody else talking to class, there's no excuses. You got in trouble. You made the bad decision. Here's the repercussions. And I believe very strongly in that. And my wife, as a teacher in my children's school, my children know that. And it's, I love my children. And I want them to be successful, but I will not make excuses for my children. And it does not matter what situation there was, that they're in trouble and they're accountable.
Right. And there has to be discipline in that sense.
Yeah.
When you sat down to write the book, and I say write in the sense that you probably used a computer, not the old quill, the pen and quill thing, quill and ink. When you decided to write the book, what was the main message you wanted to get out? And I know we've talked a little bit about it in terms of because of the title of the book, but if you can expand on that just a little bit or expound on that, what's the main message that you wanted to get out to people?
The main message: you matter. The decisions that you make matter. Every American has a role in raising this generation. They discount their role, like, oh, national security, it's this big government problem, they're going to take care of it. No, it has to be you. The best resource we have in our country is you, teachers, coaches, mentors, families, those volunteers that are out there every day doing great things. That is America's best resource. When you get involved in your community, you engage that community, you're making a difference. You're helping these kids grow. You're giving them, tools to be successful. You're empowering them, and you help them build their confidence to go out and do things. And that's what's going to make America a better place. That's what I think lacks in some communities, in some of this younger generation, because they just were shut out for a huge 2 or 3 year span in there, which was critical in their development. And they just lack some of those skills and some of that confidence. We have to build that back. Or when we try to hand the keys over to this generation, whether that's 20, 25, 30 years, we are going to be in big trouble. I don't know anyone. I don't know any teachers that work with this generation and say, man, these kids are ready to lead. Mm-hmm. There's always outliers, and I've seen some great kids that are coming through the military that I get to work with and mentor as a commander. Just on the whole, I don't think they're ready for leadership.
You think there's also in this generation coming up a sense of entitlement that past generations didn't have? They expect,
yes,
just on a material level, let alone anything else, they want, they expect a car and they expect this. And when they go to a job, it's not that they're going to find out about the job and do it to the best of their ability. They want to know how much time off and, what are the perks. And that I'm generalizing here, obviously, but
you're correct. And with this generation, as a prior business owner as well, that has a lot to do with parenting. Everybody gets a trophy, they want to not trivialize, but they just kind of want to downgrade like winners and winning. Like everyone is special. And don't get me wrong, everybody is special. Everyone brings something to the table. I love all three of my children, but that sense of entitlement has come from the parenting style and some of the cultural things that we're doing in this country that does our children a disservice. Real life does have winners and losers. When you make bad choices and there's bad outcomes, you only have yourself to blame. You can't blame the people around you or your teachers. You have to have that personal accountability. And that's one of the chapters in the book talks specifically about accountability, integrity, ability to adapt and overcome obstacles. Those are all chapters in that first section of the book that these are lessons the kids have to learn that I don't think they're learning right now. in a lot of households and in many schools, and it's leading to the issues that we see.
Is there a remedial plan for one that you recommend that could be applied to that generation that was shut out during COVID? Not looking past them to the next generation, which wasn't shut out, or to generations before, but specifically that generation that you talk about, where because of COVID, they lost a lot of skill learning. And is there a way to remediate that in some way?
Has to be personal one-on-one time with your coaches, sporting events, you know, getting involved in sports, or maybe it can be some other educational extracurricular activities. Join the chess club, theater, the arts, you know, getting involved in these children. And just has to be that one-on-one mentorship, like volunteer. And that's how you coach these kids up, and you talk to them and you mention these things. When they show up late for practice, hey, you know, this is about personal accountability. You have to show up on time. Your team is really relying on you. And it's about personal integrity. Like, are you doing everything you can to make yourself better and make this team better? It has to be that one-on-one time with coaches, mentors, teachers, and your family. Hopefully you're getting that from your family at home. You know, everyone parents a little bit differently, but these are things that have to be done. And you can't do that over an iPad. You can't do that over video. You got to do that one-on-one, and that's where people engaging their community are going to have that impact. That's really the biggest message I'm trying to get out there.
You talked about the cultural impact of it all. There's also the racial impact, and what I mean by that, and that's partially cultural too, because it depends on whether you're coming from the middle class or a different level. But there's also if you are admonished, for example, or disciplined because of something that you should be held accountable for, there's sometimes the term that you're picking out someone because of race rather than behavior. So how do you work your way around that in today's society?
Yeah, well, there's all different types of barriers. You know, there's the different cultural, socioeconomic, the racial. I came from an Irish American family. My dad was raised in rural Montana. He was the first, you know, you talk about socioeconomic differences. I was the first McConkie to go to college ever. Aunts, uncles, cousins. My dad was a railroader. My grandfather was a railroader. My great grandfather was a railroader. You know, so, you know, there's those. And then my wife was raised in a Hispanic household. You know, her parents both immigrated from Cuba when they were very young children. My wife was raised in South Florida in Miami. Spanish was her native language. And, you know, there's clearly differences in how each of us were raised, but, you know, parents just holding us accountable. We had to get jobs. We had to pay for car insurance. We just those very simple basics. It doesn't matter where you're coming from or what your economic resources are. It's free to teach accountability and integrity and leadership. It doesn't cost anything for that. You can have a lot of disadvantages, but that's where parenting is so important.
And I think, too, if you're a decent person, no matter what your background is, whether it's socioeconomic or it doesn't really matter, racial or religion, if you're a decent person, you can work that out. But I sometimes think that in the political climate of today, that there are, I don't want to use forces, that sounds a little too extreme, but there are motivations on the political side to have people kind of ginned up against things that are going on instead of addressing it honestly. Is there a way around that as well?
Well, I learned that lesson the hard way in my congressional race. So I was outspent by $12 million by a candidate in my race. Her father contributed a lot of money. And having the skill set that I've got and the background, I was a Duke University professor, an emergency physician, a commander. I could not overcome just one person with $12 million. So that money really speaks volumes if you just blast out on the airwaves and have just nonstop commercials for 3 to 4 months. And I didn't really have a chance. It was very disappointing, but that's a big lesson that American politics, that is a huge component of what that's about. But you got to find a way to overcome that. And, you know, getting this message out was really the whole purpose of running in that campaign. Seeing all the issues that I see as a military commander with budget problems and our lack of readiness at times with that, you know, China threat that looms, you know, ever present, that that's why I got involved. And you know, I'm not going to whine and cry about it. I didn't win. So move on, adapt, overcome. I've got the book out and I'll get the message out that way. One way or another, you know, I will not let America fail.
Well, before I let you go, the political element too is not just the money being spent, but they tend to want to put people in silos so they identify different groups to appeal to, and then becomes more tribal than it does become individual responsibility. And again, that's to the message of your book. So before I let you go, give us the overriding important point you want to make. I know I asked you earlier about what was a key message, but there's something that may be beyond that that you would like to communicate before we finish.
Yeah, we are divided generationally and politically. And they like, you know, you say they, you know, you have the extreme left, you've got the extreme right, you know, they will use that as a weapon at times to try to separate people. But when it really comes down, we have so much more in common than we have that separates us. We all want the same thing. We all want to raise our children. We want to give our children a good education. We all want our children to be successful. I don't think there's a single American right now that doesn't agree that building our future really starts with this next generation of Americans. And so regardless of all the political division, and we can all disagree on politics and policies all day long, but everybody agrees how important it is to build leadership in this generation of Americans. So that's what we need to focus on. That's what the book is about. And we have a lot of work to do.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Colonel Joshua M. McConkie, MD. He's author of Be the Weight Behind the Spear, W-E-I-G-H-T, but it could also be, in a way, W-A-I-T. But it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. And for everything about Josh, go to joshmcconkieforamerica.com. And give us the other website again, Josh.
Weightbehindthespear.com, W-E-I-G-H-T, weightbehindthespear.com.
And follow him on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and X, and YouTube. And Josh, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Ira. I appreciate you having me on.
You got it. And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.